It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, as we do every week, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Beat Bush.
Good morning.
With a stick.
Now.
Sorry, I kind of...
You're not going to behave.
Have a focus. Waking up every morning asking what I'm doing that morning to make sure George Bush is not reelected president of the United States.
Mm. Well, actually, I don't do that.
It's important to have goals.
It's my job.
It's important to have a life, too, outside of electoral politics.
Yeah, but unfortunately, electoral politics is what I do for a living this time of year. So.
All right, well...
When they talk about writing about politics, right now that's what politics is, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, a big day on Tuesday.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of other things going on, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
There are.
Election's important.
But you wouldn't know it sometimes by reading the papers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there is a lot of this stuff going on. But we're not going to deal with that first, are we?
No, we're not. We're going to, just like the rest of the media, we're going to focus on the elections coming up on Tuesday. And last week... You'd given us your picks for candidates.
Yes.
And that was pretty much it. And candidates.
mostly state and local candidates.
Yeah,
and
the federal, state, and local. But we didn't get to the judges, and then we didn't get to the initiatives and referendums. So we're going to do that this week. And we'll have some, this will only take about half the show, so it won't be the entire show.
Okay.
Our people were afraid we're going to talk about nothing but elections this whole show. That's not what we're going to do. This is the Eat the State recommendations, and it's in the current issue of Eat the State, which is out now in places where you get free periodicals, blah, blah, blah. And it's unfortunately not up on our website yet, but if they email you, you can get a copy of this.
Yeah, they send email to me at tomchick@drizzle.com.
And it's spelled like it sounds, Tomchick.
Yeah, Tomchick, T-O-M-C-H-I-C-K, @drizzle, D-R-I-Z-Z-L-E. com. I can send you a copy of the issue,
C-O-M.
The state, and it's got all of our election picks in it.
Okay.
Make sure you put in the subject line, Eat the State, something so that I know you're not spam.
Spam. All right, so, Jav, what do you got for us?
Well, let's start with the judges. There are a few judgeships that are on the ballot this time around. The State Justice Supreme Court, there's three different ones, one of which is unopposed, Barbara Madsen, but there are two that are contested. Position number one, we have Mary Kay Becker versus Jim Johnson. Jim Johnson, for people who don't know the name, he's run for high office a couple times in the past, including for a state Supreme Court at least once before. He is, among other things, best known for his anti-Native American work while working under Slade Gordon as Assistant Attorney General of the state. And then more recently, among other things, he's been Tim Eymann's lawyer on a number of his initiatives and is really fairly well-connected and well-known in right-wing conservative circles. Very, very problematic in terms of many of his views for state Supreme Court. He might be a good civil libertarian, but that would be far outweighed by a number of his other stances. So we're recommending Mary Kay Becker in that race. State Supreme Court Justice number five, as I said, Barbara Madsen is unopposed. And then the other position, we have Richard Sanders, who is also conservative, but he is an outstanding civil libertarian. He's been somewhat controversial, parsed out for some ethics violations here and there, but he has been one of the few voices on the state Supreme Court that has been really strong in favor of putting checks on expanding state power and expanding police powers and all of the things that have come with the Patriot Act and the post 9/11 mindset, as the buzzword is now going around. So he's worth keeping. Court of Appeals, Judge District 1, Division 1, C. Kenneth Gross is unopposed. Skip that. We have Julia Garrett for a Superior Court Judge, position number 23. She's experienced. She served as a public defender and a prosecutor, parole board member, as a Superior Court Judge pro tem, much more qualified than Andrea Darvas, who is her opponent. So that's Julia Garrett for position number 23. For position 42, I'm recommending Catherine Moore. She has a background as a family law judge. She's worked in domestic violence and is a strong advocate for abused and dispossessed women. Lawyer Chris Washington is her opponent, and he's really not got that much experience that I can tell, other than being a trial lawyer and a he's not as well qualified as Catherine Moore, in my opinion. Anyway, those are the judges. There aren't that many of them this time. But there are a lot of initiatives and referendums. We have IEAT72, which is the Grange's effort to reform the primary system. If you didn't like the primary system we had this time, they're saying, well, here's the Louisiana style instead. And this is the style where you have the top two vote getters, regardless of party, advance to the general election. This has two major problems. The first of which is that it virtually guarantees that it shuts out third parties from the general election ballot. The second one is that the major parties don't like it either. And what they have said is that if this passes, they will simply not hold primaries at all. They'll go to a convention system to nominate their candidates, so voters won't have a choice at all in terms of who gets to the general election ballot. So we're recommending a no vote on that one, on Initiative 872. I-884, this is the education initiative. It's the right issue and the wrong mechanism. It adds a nearly 10% sales tax in King County would be the result of this. It adds a 1% sales tax across the board statewide. In order to fund education. Education needs funding, but it needs funding as part of the general fund, as part of the basic budget, not as part of goofy mechanisms like this that are funded through regressive sales taxes. So that's a no vote on that. Initiative 892, this is Tim Eyman's work for this year. This year he's gone to work for the in-state gambling interests who are up against the tribal casinos. They want some of the...
Well, although, isn't one of the big supporters Canadian Gambling Corporation?
Oh, yeah, that's true, too. Mm-hmm. You're right.
So he's really kind of working for...
I meant out-of-state. I'm sorry.
Out-of-state gambling interests, yeah.
I said that wrong. Thank you. He's gone to work for out-of-state gambling interests. Uh-huh. They're up against the in-state tribal casinos, is what I meant to say.
Okay.
The tribal casinos at this point have the ability to play some games in their casinos that other folks can't because of their status as sovereign nations. And Eyman has attached this to a property tax rollback. Again, it's the right idea but the wrong mechanism. Property taxes are also regressive, and they're overdue for some sort of voter revolt. This is the wrong one. This is 18,000 more electronic scratch tickets, and as we all know, gambling is yet another one of those taxes that primarily singles out poor people and people who want to be separated from their money. It's just not a good idea.
Wasn't Eyman and the supporters of this initiative saying that it was going to be revenue neutral, that it wouldn't take any money from state coffers, but in fact it does, because the state runs its own gambling games that would probably be widely ignored once gambling is expanded in other venues in the state?
Yeah, that's true. The electronic scratch tickets are basically identical to what the state lottery mm-hmm. does.
Yeah, so it would actually severely impact the state budget just the way other... pretty much the same way other Tim Eyman initiatives have.
Yeah, and also the same way other Eyman initiatives have, in that he's not being upfront about that.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a good point.
So a no on that initiative.
Yeah. We have Referendum 55, which is the Charter Schools Bill, which was referred to the voters. Charter schools are turning out to be somewhat problematic, not only... And we haven't talked about this much in this program. I don't know how you feel about them. I'm not that much of a fan of them. It's like this thing that in theory is a great idea, but in practice it tends to undermine public education. And it also turns out they don't perform that well. Students in charter schools actually don't do any better than students in regularly funded public schools do.
Yeah, I don't see why you would remove children from the public education system to put them in a privatized a system that is a step towards privatization of education in order to get the same results. I don't understand what the thinking is behind that, other than to break the teachers' union.
Yeah,
that's
which is
really how
a
I view
part
it.
Of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a no on that. We're being just sort of irascible and no oriented.
No's on all of these.
Except we have yes on this one. This is Initiative 297 for Hanford. This is Hanford Cleanup. These are our friends at Heart of America Northwest have helped put this together, along with Physicians for Social Responsibility and some other fine groups out there. This is to ban low-level nuclear waste from being imported to the Hanford Nuclear Reservation by the feds. Now, this is probably going to wind up in the courts. They're claiming claiming that the feds would have to agree to this because of the states having jurisdiction over cleanup agreements for Superfund sites. But I think the feds are likely to fight this. But anything that can draw attention to Hanford, draw attention to the need for cleanup, and stop the situation from getting even worse there is a step in the right direction. So a yes on I-297.
Yes.
And then we have the goofy ones, the local ones this year. We have the King County Alternative Proposed Charter Amendments 1A and 1B. This is actually also one that Iman had something to do with. This was initially started by the GL Guards Union, the initiative to drop the King County Council size from 13 to 9 seats. This is their revenge for suffering slight cutbacks in their budget when everybody else was getting cut back more. So they're saying this would be a cost-cutting move, but it really isn't that much of a cost-cutting move. You've got a county that's one of the largest in the country with a steadily growing population, and it would decrease representation in that sense. And you also have the fact that with the redistricting and the influence of the suburban seats, it would tend to shift the balance of power toward Republicans and the county council. So vote no on that. But then they also ask whether if it's a yes vote, whether you want the seats reduced from 13 to 9 in 2005 or 2007. So you might as well vote for 2007, given a choice between the two. But I really don't understand why that's on the ballot. But that's not nearly as peculiar as King County Advisory Measures 1A, 1 and 2. These are advisory measures, meaning that they have no weight of law whatsoever. They're just advisory. This is basically the powers that be trying to determine whether people will vote for a regional transportation plan, and if they'll vote for it, what sort of funding mechanism they would want to have pay for it. You know, is a transportation plan a good idea? Well, duh, of course it is. The devil is always in the details, but they're not giving you any details on this, so you might as well vote yes.
They're asking you for the details.
Yeah, they're asking you for the details. They're asking you whether you want to support it with a gas tax, with a tax on motor vehicles, with, you know, all sorts of different options. Of the options given for revenue for the transportation plan, the gas tax is probably the most fair, I think.
Because it's based on,
It's a user fee. It's
based on how much you use the system.
Exactly. It's based on how much benefit you get from the system, actually. So mm-hmm. So that's it for the ballot for 2004.
What about the monorail measure?
Oh, I missed the monorail. You're right. That's the last one.
Thought you were going to put that in the goofy local.
Oh, no.
Category.
We could. It actually is kind of goofy that we're voting on this for the fourth time. And this is interesting because we had a disagreement on this 2 years ago when the monorail was initially up. But I voted against the monorail the first time around, but I am voting against the recall because I think, you know, once the voters have approved it, you know, the train needs to leave the station at some point. It's far enough along that that there would be a tremendous cost for pulling the plug at this point, and particularly the cost comes in the city's ability in the future to raise bonds for capital projects, because people are looking at this and it's sort of like the Seattle way gone out of control, where you have just this endless process and this endless hand-wringing and nothing ever gets done. You know, at some point you've got to actually make a decision, and a decision has to be final. And you know, I just don't see this recall as being a good idea, even though the flaws that were with the monorail when we voted on it the first time around are still very much with us, and they're in fact what the recall campaign is basing its efforts on, is pointing at this and saying, "See, we told you so."
Yeah, and the way I view it is the recall campaign has some interesting points, some of which are legitimate, like portions of the monorail going from two track to one track in parts of the route, I think you should vote for the monorail and then push for a two track system along the entire route. Now, the other objections to the monorail, like the fact that they're not collecting as much tax revenue as they thought they were, they're actually doing some things to close the gap on that. So it's not as if those are problems that are continuing to be ignored and they're doing something about it.
These are solvable problems.
Yeah, they're solvable problems. And other things are, you know, other objections are based on things that you just don't know for sure. Like the recall folks are saying, you know, the monorail is going to just take riders from the bus system. Well, we don't know that for sure. If that were the case with the monorail, it would probably be the case with Sound Transit. So why build the Sound Transit light rail system? The truth is that when you put in a major new transit project like that, you attract people who have never ridden transit before. That's something that just hasn't been discussed in this. People are curious. They want to try it out. They want to check it out. You do take people out of their cars. Now, it's whether the system functions efficiently or not that determines whether those people actually stick with it and enjoy it and want to ride it. And I think that monorail has proven in other countries, particularly in Japan, that that's the case, that people give up their cars to ride a system that's efficient and quick and that they don't have to be in their car stuck in traffic, worried about worried about parking and getting there on time and getting into accidents, etc.
Yeah, some of the problems with the monorail, you know, the public-private partnerships around the development of the stations, the switch to a single-track system in a lot of areas, which has problems both for the routing software and for any kind of future expansion of the monorail. You know, these are things that citizen involvement can help fix. These are things that we need to be paying attention. We don't need to be pulling the plug on it. So I think we're in agreement on this.
And the only other big objection that the recall folks cite is that the monorail system won't pay for itself. And I have to ask folks, what transit system, what transportation system pays for itself?
Cars, motor vehicles,
cars don't pay for themselves. You know, roadways don't pay for themselves. The government has to pay for that. You know, you have to pay for that with your tax dollars. Sound Transit is never going to pay for itself. We will always pay some money to run it. There's no transit system, no transportation system in the world that totally pays for itself.
Yeah, that's what government is for.
Yeah.
Except for walking.
Walking and riding your bike.
You gotta buy the food. Sorry about that. You still got to buy the food.
Yeah, but the payback is good health.
Yeah,
so.
You still kind of would like sidewalks or paths or something that you can walk on that isn't too difficult. So there's no transportation system that totally pays for itself.
All right. Well, let's. Is that it? Is that it for the election?
That's it for the election.
Let's
leave
move
that
on.
One behind. Okay.
Yeah.
let's jump over to international and this week in Iraq. This week in Iraq.
I just want to talk about a little bit about how the international community has already logged their votes on in our U.S. presidential election. You thought we were getting away from you thought we were getting away from elections, but we're really not. We're sort of still talking about them. First of all, the leak of the Iraqi explosives debacle this week. Now, it's kind of interesting because of the timing of this. The Iraqi Ministry of Science and Technology, which is an arm of the interim government in Iraq, which was appointed by the U.S., told the International Atomic Energy Agency on October 10th that about 350 tons of high explosives were missing from the Al-Qaqa military complex in Iraq. Now, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association, which is a part of the UN, on October 15th told the Bush administration about this and said that they had some major concerns and wanted some explanation from the Bush administration. However, they didn't hear anything. The Bushies just sat on it and wanted it to wait until after the election. And so the IAEA, because the Bush administration has been thinking of replacing their head, Mohammed El-Baradei, because he's not been with the U.S.'s plan in Iraq, he turned around and said, well, I'm going to release this. And he on Monday of this week, released it to the press and sent a letter to and it made a presentation at the UN, said, well, there's this about 350 tons of high explosives that have been looted and is missing in Iraq. Well, then came the denials. The Bush administration said, well, no, you know, it was moved by the Saddam Hussein regime. And then the interim government lodged another vote and said, well, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't moved by
and the videotape came up, yeah,
that's coming. The interim government first, they said, no, I'm sorry, we know that it wasn't moved by the Saddam Hussein regime, that it was there, and that it was moved after the fall of Baghdad. And then some reporters from the New York Times and from the Lebanon Daily Star actually went to the Al-Qaqa complex, and they interviewed the people who work there and the people who live nearby. And all of those folks said, well, we never saw anything moved out of that site until afterwards. Until after some U.S. troops came through and Baghdad fell. And then in late April, a whole bunch of looters came. And there were so many of them coming to the Al-Qaqa complex, which was unguarded at that point, after U.S. soldiers had already been there. There were no guards posted. All these looters came, and in about the space of 2 weeks, they hauled everything away, including those high explosives. Now, that didn't make the U.S. press too much. I mean, there was a small article on it in the New York Times. But then an NBC News reporter said that she was at the Al-Qaqa complex on April 10th, which is very close to about the time when Baghdad fell. She was there as part of an embedded unit, and she said that there was no search done and there was no security posted at the site. So, of course, just listening to local Iraqis wasn't enough. We had to hear it from an NBC News reporter. And then shortly after that, a couple of embedded reporters from an ABC affiliate had in Minnesota had rummaged around in their archives and found this videotape that was taken on about April 12th that showed U.S. soldiers actually going to a bunker at Al-Qaqa and breaking the seals, the International Atomic Energy Agency's seals on the bunkers, opening them up, and lo and behold, there were the explosives under seal. Now, after breaking the seals, the shocking thing is that the soldiers posted no guard and they left it open so that looters could come and just take whatever they wanted. That's something that hasn't been discussed much in the media here, and it should be, how the Bush administration knew, because the International Atomic Energy Agency told them before the invasion that there were these sites that would need to be protected, and there was nothing, absolutely nothing done. I think the big question about this is, why is this coming out now? And the answer, of course, to that is that some folks in the interim government in Iraq are unhappy with the Pentagon and the Bush administration. So they've kind of logged their vote. Now, in addition, France voted this week, or actually has been working to lodge their vote for a couple of weeks now. They've succeeded in delaying a conference on the future of Iraq that was set to be held in Egypt in October. The Bush administration wanted it held in October as part of their sort of run-up to the election campaign, saying, see, we're really doing something here. We're getting the international community on board. And France kind of dug in their heels, and they made some demands that have delayed the conference until after the election. It's set now for November 22nd. In addition, France is probably going to block the U.S. in this conference by asking for a date for withdrawal of troops from Iraq. And that's something that isn't required by the U.N. resolution that governs the election coming up in January and the writing of the Constitution, et cetera, in Iraq. And actually, the resolution says that no date for withdrawal of troops has to be set until December 2005. But France recognizes, as do many people who are watching the situation there in Iraq, including me, that you have to set a date for the withdrawal of U.S. troops to have any kind of an impact on the level of violence in Iraq today. It has to be done as soon as possible. So I also want to say, too, that the insurgents voted this week by doing a massacre of about 49 Iraqi National Guard and about 11 Iraqi police. It's interesting because here in the U.S., following the line of the Bush administration, U.S. reporters have covered this as an action by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, saying that Tawhid and Jihad, his group, had claimed responsibility for it. However, if you look at the message that they posted on their website, actually, there are factual differences between their message and what U.S. troops and reporters found on the ground at the massacre site. So it's obvious that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had nothing to do with the massacre of the Iraqi National Guard troops, that it was actually insurgents that did it. They're basically using these kinds of attacks against the Iraqi people and against Iraqi forces and against the U.S. military as a way to log their vote in the U.S. presidential election. Now, London's...
And we also had Iyad Alawi coming out and accusing the administration of gross negligence.
Yeah, and he was right.
With regard to that.
He was right when he said, you know, the administration was extremely negligent in this because they sent these guys home from the training camp with no guns and no protection at all, not even an escort. He was absolutely right. There's nothing else in Iraq that would account for 49 guys riding home in three trucks, you know, in one convoy, other than that they were training for the Iraqi National Guard. You know, I mean, that's a clear signal. Even, you know, they didn't necessarily even have to have infiltrated the group to know that these guys were Iraqi National Guard. There's nothing else going on in Iraq that would account for that number of people being together of a certain age and all being male, other than that there were trainees coming from a camp. So it really was pretty negligent. You'd have to be stupid not to know that they would come under attack.
Yeah, between that and Al-Qaqa, it seems to me that there's a real story here that is not being covered of how people within the interim government are really upset with the Pentagon and with the Bush administration.
Yeah, that's true.
They're very unpopular, even though these are the guys that we appointed.
Yeah. Now, Iyad Alawi is still very much following the U.S. line. He's talking about, you know, attacking Fallujah and they have to give up the foreign terrorists. There are no foreign terrorists in Fallujah. If there are, there's like one or two. There's like hardly any at all. But he's still talking about you got to give up the foreign terrorists or we're going to attack Fallujah, et cetera, et cetera. That's all, you know, a script that was handed him by the Bush administration. On the other hand, he and some of his employees are also pretty mad about the way the U.S. is not handling the situation in Iraq, the security situation, in a way that makes any kind of sense. So that's a split that's coming up, and I think that's why we're seeing some of this stuff happening right before the election. Now, at the same time, London scientists at the Lancet Medical Journal released the results of a study enumerating the civilian deaths in Iraq since the start of the war. And it turns out that in this study that was conducted by Johns Hopkins University and Columbia University and a university in Baghdad, that about 100,000 Iraqis have died since the invasion. It was based on face-to-face interviews with Iraqi families all over the country, so in 36 different regions of the country, using a statistical method that is highly respected and considered very accurate. It was the same method used to count war deaths in Kosovo in the late 1990s. Most of the deaths, this is the striking part, most of the deaths have occurred from the violence of war and the continuing insurgency, with the highest number being caused by U.S. airstrikes. And those
as the ones now going on in Fallujah.
Yes, and those airstrikes are continuing in Fallujah. Now, we can kind of wrap up by saying that there was another international figure that lodged his vote in our U.S. presidential elections, and that's Osama bin Laden. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about that job.
Well, simply put, he's trying to have influence in the American elections. I don't think he will particularly, but simply the presence on Al Jazeera and saying that he's out there 3 years after, you know, he was supposedly wanted dead or alive is very much a reminder that the Bush administration has utterly failed in what one would think would be its primary objective, which is to bring this guy and his organization to justice. It simply has not happened, and he's rubbing our noses in it, and he's trying to remind American voters that, you know, hasn't happened.
Well, in addition, he said some interesting things, too. He said that it doesn't matter whether Bush or Kerry wins. The problem is it's U.S. long-term foreign policy. And he was absolutely right in saying that it's the U.S. people who make a difference in what U.S. foreign policy does to people abroad. And that doesn't mean that I support Osama bin Laden. It just means that these people we call terrorists and demonize are people who have seen the effects of our foreign policy, and they have legitimate points, even though they use the wrong strategies for dealing with it.
Yep, thank you.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every other week with news and opinions, and as we said, it has their election picks this time, which you can find at places where you find free publications, bookstores, cafes, places like that. Our editions are also online. Hopefully we'll have our new one online any moment now at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you have feedback, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.
And if you want a copy of our election issue and you can't find it on the web, you can send me email at tomchick, T-O-M-C-H-I-C-K, at drizzle.com, and I'll send you a copy by email.